Hi, it's the 29th of March, 2024. This is the Room Now podcast. I'm Jack Cush, executive editor with RoomNow.com. You know, I started this week doing a few new things. One that you may notice is I want to do a few more Twitter polls. I want to put up more gems and pearls and quotes. I'm going to try to do one of those every day. I think that they are things that we should be sharing amongst each other. So I'll begin today's podcast with one of the gems I put up this week, which is about where you sit in a clinic. You know, actually, I wrote a pretty good blog on that called Where You Sit, which I think is kind of funny. It has to do with where patients sit. But I'm really talking about where you sit. Like, where is your clinic desk that you work at? Some of us go into our offices, or we have a clinic work desk that's away from patients in the work area. I think it's best that you be in a position where you can see patients and they can see you. I got to tell you, I think I've learned a tremendous amount about patient care, about watching the way patients walk into clinic and leave clinic and interact with the staff. I think that my patients learn a lot by seeing how and where I work. So just my advice, you may have a different opinion. Maybe you need your silence, your little cocoon to gather your thoughts and do your work. But I think that the powers of observation can extend beyond the usual confines of the exam room. I've always been concerned about the strength of my patients and think I don't pay enough attention to the strength of my patients, especially as it relates to falls. And there was a nice article in JAMA this week about falls in the elderly and fall prevention. It's probably worth reviewing. The stats on it are pretty interesting. Greater than 25% of the elderly over 65 will fall. That falls in that age group are associated with significant rates of hospitalization, if not mortality, and that there are many programs and good objective evidence showing that fall prevention through physical therapy and referral to physical therapy clearly have a significant benefit, at least a 30% benefit in most of the studies. My physical therapy departments where I work have fall prevention programs for the elderly, and you should really think about that, especially anyone who's older, anyone who does have arthritis and has gotten weaker, and anyone who's currently using a walker, cane, or any walking assist device. This should be something as part of your routine. I looked up chikungunya arthritis this week, yes, to refresh my abilities to spell chikungunya. As you know, a mosquito-borne illness that does produce an acute and a chronic inflammatory polyarthritis. And I've had a few cases of this. The most recent ones, Rob Schoen had a nice article from University of Connecticut looking at 31 patients and how they treated them. Another study from Brazil, 133 patients, and they both kind of came to the same conclusion, that there is a value to steroid therapy in patients who have post-chikungunya polyarthritis, and the doses there were up to 4 milligrams per day with clear-cut benefits either at an 8-week time point or at a 5-month time point. But the question in both those studies was whether or not the addition of methotrexate, or in the Brazilian study, orlaflunomide, offered any greater protection. It wasn't clear that it did. So I must say, in the two patients that I've had who were infected, one in the Caribbean, one in India, I did use methotrexate afterwards because that was an early report suggesting its utility. Don't know if that's worth it. I don't think there's a real harm to it, but I'd be quick to bail on it. Be interested in hearing what the experts think on that. Interesting study from Norway looking at how much pain tolerance is related to one's physical activity level. And this study of more than 10,000 adults showed that more physically active individuals had higher levels of pain tolerance. They were specifically measured for pain tolerance, and it was objectively significantly different. Again, this goes to the point that being active, being stronger, leads to better outcomes, even pain outcomes, as indicated by this study from Norway. A study from Korea looked at a large cohort of patients on TNF inhibitors. 526 patients on TNF inhibitors who were on the drug for more than a year, were in great shape and tapered. How many do you think flared with tapering of their biologic? As you've heard me before, this is nutso. Why would you struggle to get someone in remission and then allow them to taper their drugs? These are chronic illnesses. They don't go away. But yes, nearly 25% of these people experienced the flare. Predictors of flare were being B27 positive, having inflammatory back pain, psoriasis, a family history of SpA, diabetes, and dropping the dose by more than 50% or more. And disease activity was another predictor for subsequent flare rates. Don't allow them to flare by not allowing them to taper. Biobidacer, as you know, is a Spanish registry. In this particular study, they looked at patients who had RA in their registry, treated with their first biologic or targeted synthetic, over 1,128 patients exactly. What's the rate of multimorbidity? And it was 9.3%. You know, it's kind of online with what's been seen in other studies. And what's also in line is that patients with multimorbidity had greater levels of disease activity. But the interesting thing is that these people were treated with a variety of different therapies, biologics and JAK inhibitors, but they found no difference in retention rates when they compared patients with multimorbidity to those without. And I would think if they had higher disease activity with multimorbidity, that they probably wouldn't do as well on therapy, and there would be differences in their biologic or JAK retention rates, but they did not see that. So I wonder what that means. I wonder if that means they didn't have alternatives to change to, or whether the activity changes here weren't, maybe they were statistically significant, but not clinically meaningful. Other studies have shown really clinically meaningful differences in disease activity. Anyway, it's an interesting observation that we probably requires other study. Pregnancy study from Korea looked at what was associated with adverse pregnancy outcomes. This was 5,728 pregnancies, over 1,152 adverse pregnancy outcomes. For these people with RA, the most commonly used drug during pregnancy was hydroxychloroquine. Almost all of them that were on DMARD stopped or decreased their DMARD use during pregnancy, but they did show that the use of methotrexate or leflunomide within 3 months of conception was associated with significantly higher rates of adverse pregnancy outcomes. That usually means like miscarriage and things like that, not usually fetal malformations. But the odds ratio is twofold higher rates of adverse pregnancy outcomes when there was prior methotrexate or leflunomide use. You know, methotrexate and leflunomide has been shown not to be as horrible as we think it is. I would not routinely recommend to the patient that they, you know, have elective abortion because a patient conceived on methotrexate leflunomide. There are many studies showing that they do well. But this data says it's not foolproof, meaning that they may be able to make a normal, healthy baby, but they may have slightly higher rates of adverse pregnancy outcomes when exposed. Found an interesting observation that I did not know exists. Autoimmune disease patients having higher rates of macular degeneration. What? I saw a literature report on this and a report from the Cleveland Clinic looking at many different types of autoimmune disease and reported rates of macular degeneration. So lupus patients, relative risk 1.73, scleroderma 1.65, psoriasis 1.48. So 48% higher, 48% higher in vasculitis, 40% higher in RA, 42% higher in IBD, and 42% higher in sarcoid. All those are significant. What's going on there? Autoimmune disease leading to macular degeneration? Now, they didn't go into what the other contributors could be here, like disease activity, like drug and steroid exposure. But maybe it's not unreasonable that we pay attention to macular degeneration in our patients with autoimmune disease. The CDC this past week issued an update to its numbers on drug overdose deaths. You know, it's a major epidemic in the United States. But you know what? The numbers are still high, and the last reported year is 2022. The number nationwide is 107, almost 108,000 deaths, 1% higher than the year before. And the preliminary look at the 2023 numbers looks like it's steady, and we're expecting the same. This continues to be a major public health problem. I know many of you are not really even using opioids anymore, or are reluctant to prescribe it. So you wonder where this problem still exists and why is it persisting? Scary. High complication rates are seen in patients with RA who undergo joint revision surgery, and the major one being periprosthetic infections. This is a study of 54 prosthetic joint infections. The average age here in these people who got the infections after a revision was 65 years of age. The mortality rate was nearly 20%. Most common bugs were staph, 63%, and 20% were multi-organism infections, and 6 were culture negative. These can be hard to diagnose. A high index of suspicion is required in your patients undergoing joint revision or joint surgery, especially if they have RA as a background. I actually put up a review article on PJI's prosthetic joint infections in yesterday's Room Now, with a number of takeaway messages from a lot of the orthopedic literature on this. Kind of interesting, and you as a rheumatologist need to stay abreast of that. So I think most of us are overworked on the EMR, EHR. A particular study, I think this appeared in JAMA, looked at since COVID, time that you spend on the medical record, the EHR, has increased 157% compared to pre-pandemic levels. And that most of that EHR time was spent taken up by you having to do messaging with patients. This is uncompensated time. And, you know, it's basically the rise of the patient portal and patients getting more adept at using it. And the question is, how are you using it, and how much is it killing you? And are there more effective ways of doing this? And should you be paid for this? These are things that need to be discussed. Two last reports I think are major ones for rheumatologists. One is that there is a window of opportunity for patients with psoriatic arthritis. This is a Dutch study of 708 patients, consecutive psoriatic arthritis patients, who were classified on the delay from being referred, symptom onset, to being referred to a rheumatologist and then diagnosed. So the first time point, I think, was 12 weeks and 24 weeks, and then after 24 weeks. The bottom line is the people who did the best were the ones who had the shortest delay in referral, and that those people were almost 2.5 times more likely to achieve minimal disease activity, MDA status, and DAPSA remission, 2.3-fold higher than compared to patients with longer delays. Again, there are significant delays in many of the different spondyloarthropathies, including psoriatic arthritis. And I think that we need to, enact efforts to promote earlier referral. Those who did worse and had the longest delays were more likely to be women, those who had enthesitis and chronic low back pain, and those with normal CRP levels. There's a lesson in here for future practice and planning your future practices. The other thing I thought was interesting is this idea of having secondary Sjogren's syndrome. What does it do to the presence of RA? So secondary Sjogren's, at least 20% of patients are going to have secondary Sjogren's. These people are more likely to have a more severe RA phenotype. It's based on a study of nearly 6,000 patients, RA patients, of whom 337 had concomitant Sjogren's disease. They were all being treated with, you know, a biologic or a JAK inhibitor. And those who had Sjogren's were more likely to be female, seropositive, have higher disease activity, and more radiographic erosions. At 1 year after advanced treatment, those with secondary Sjogren's were less likely to achieve remission status and more likely to stop their TNF inhibitor and their non-TNF inhibitor and their JAK inhibitor. Now, it was significant for stopping a TNF inhibitor, and it was a trend, numeric trend, for the other two. So secondary Sjogren's may portend a more difficult patient. Now, is that because secondary Sjogren's really is a lot of fibromyalgia, or is it really that it's another autoimmune inflammatory disease contributing to worse outcomes? Pay attention to that. We'll see where it goes. That's it for this week on the podcast. Tune in next week when we'll have more cool things to discuss. Take care.